to Video Store. My name is Sam Mulberry. Today we are talking about the 1957 film Heaven Knows Mr. Allison. So let's step into Barrett Fisher's Video Store. Barrett, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Barrett, what is your history with this film? I'm just going to jump right in.
You know, I'm trying to remember. I know that I watched it about a year ago, maybe a little bit less, and I'm trying to remember what led me there, and I honestly don't. Another film that we could, you might pair with this film would be about 10 years later, John Boorman makes a film called Hell in the Pacific with Toshirô Mifune and Lee Marvin. And I know my son is a big fan of that film, so I may have worked my way backwards from Hell in the Pacific to this film. Otherwise, I really don't remember how I came across it.
So this is something that you've only recently seen, though.
Within the last year or so. Okay. Yeah.
I was wondering if this was a Robert Mitchum, drew you to this at some point, or.
Yeah, it could have been Mitchum, of course. As you know, I love Robert Mitchum, but in this case, it was really because we had just seen Deborah Carr in Black Narcissus, and I wanted to see her in another nun role.
Well, that's interesting because another draw to this movie is John Huston. Mm-hmm. So this is actually the third John Huston film we've talked about. And interestingly, it's like we've watched one thing from early in his career. We watched Treasure of Sierra Madre, which is his fifth film from 1948. We watched The Man Who Would Be King, which is his 31st film in 1975. And this is his 14th film from 1957. So we've sampled little pieces of Huston's filmography. So he makes 39 films total, I think he directs. And I was surprised because I didn't think about John Huston when I was started to watch this. And I was surprised when I went back and was like, how many John Huston films have I seen? I've actually seen, this is my eighth John Huston film I've seen, which is surprising because he's not somebody that I think of as like, oh, that's a director that I have any particular feelings for. And some of these films I had seen and not necessarily associated with him. So I've also seen The Maltese Falcon, which is from 1941, Key Largo, African Queen, Annie, and The Dead. So some stuff. So some of his earliest stuff and his latest stuff I had experience with. But again, I didn't think about John Huston as I was watching this. And it's kind of an interesting career. It makes me wonder, like, what makes a John Huston film to you?
Well, you know, typically, well, I mean, first of all, as you've already suggested, Sam, with such a range, it might be difficult to say what makes a Huston film. But I suppose that often a Huston film is, there's often an element of human beings placed in difficult situations that kind of have to prove themselves. And often there are tests for, particularly for men. He's really interested in the masculine experience. And so that's why in some ways, people draw both parallels and differences between this film and The African Queen, because Margaret Mitchum's character has a much kind of different agency, if you will, lack of agency, comparatively speaking, to other Huston films. So in some ways, when I think of a typical Huston film, I do think of Treasure of Sierra Madre, think of African Queen, I think of certainly the Man Who Would Be King. But the other thing is also often typical of a Huston film, and this is an interesting contrast to Black Narcissus, is Huston loves location filming. And sometimes this has resulted in some disasters of various kinds. A year after this, he makes a film called Roots of Heaven, which doesn't do well at all, in part because of complications from location shooting. So in some ways it has that element of a Huston film. It's got the situation of these two people kind of unknown to each other. But at the same time, he tamps down the virility. He tamps down the masculinity a little bit.
I'm so glad to hear you say that because I've reached a point where we've done enough movies where whenever I ask you a question like that, I try to write down an answer myself to be like, okay, am I going to be even close? And I wrote Pictures of Masculinity Encountering the Complexities and Forces of a Larger World.
Okay,
and also the, as you pointed out with the location shooting, there's also often something about like the natural world, whether it's The Man Who Would Be King, Treasure of Sierra Madre, this, The African Queen, right? There's this sense of like, there are the forces beyond them are not just like, you know, the forces, the kind of underworld forces of the Maltese Falcon, but there's also like the natural world is a character in this movie, you know, kind of to a certain degree.
Well, I'm glad you said that, Sam, because among the reviews I read, there was one of the slightly negative ones faulted the film because it didn't feel as though, in fact, the island had enough character to it, that the island didn't really represent enough of a threat to the characters. And of course, you know, there's that scene early on when Mr. Allison talks about, you know, it sounds like something out of The Tempest. There's everything here we need to survive. And the whole first part of the film kind of turns the island into, you know, it's like an Arcadian idol. We could talk about that later. I would argue that that's because Houston isn't really interested in the island. He's interested in the Japanese and the threat that they pose. The other thing I want to say, just before I forget about it, is we talk about the span of his career. The cinematographer of this film, Oswald Morris, worked with Houston on about a half a dozen films, including The Man Who Would Be King, for what that's worth.
So in terms of thinking about nature, I want to come back to this because I think this is a bigger conversation. But my argument to the person who says the island isn't enough of a character is, I agree the island is not a character, but I have written in my notes, the third lead of this movie is the waves.
Oh, okay.
because that is a visual motif that repeats over and over, and not just, yeah, we see the waves, but he lingers on them, and he lingers on people look on the island staring out at the waves as they continue to crash. So I want to come back to that because I have an English professor here, and I want to talk about, okay, this seems like a theme. Let's talk about symbolism. So we'll come back to that. But to me, the nature is not the island. The nature is the wave. Okay. And that's even where the movie opens. I also need to say, when I was watching this movie, this is me kind of being dumb. I was like, man, there's parts of this that remind me of The African Queen. And I didn't even think to myself that is a John Huston movie, to realize like, okay, yeah, he's revisiting something, but, you know, shuffling the deck a little bit. I mean, that is a, you know, a religious woman meeting a kind of rugged man of the world during a time of war in an exotic location. And so I was like, wow, he's really cribbing off of whoever made that movie. And then I realized, well, it's himself, in fact, but he's changed it, and the changes that he makes make this movie really, really interesting to me. This was a setup I very much enjoyed. Now, one of the things that I need to say going into this is, much like when we watch Westerns on this movie, this movie falls into a window of like the close of World War II, or maybe even the beginning of World War II, and sort of the beginnings of Vietnam, or at least like the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, right? There's this window in there, kind of the era of American victory culture. There are historians who have sort of named this cultural time period. And I think there's a lot of World War II films and a lot of Westerns made during that time. And I have I have not seen a lot of these, but I have this like, internal aversion to those, because I'm like, oh, that's actually like, I know what's going on here. This is a kind of military industrial propaganda, or this is a kind of embracing of American exceptionalism or manifest destiny in different kinds of ways. So I always push back. So I have to say, I entered this movie with trepidation, thinking this is a 1957 World War II movie. My guard was up as I went into this. And I think you can tell that I really thought this movie's interesting and I enjoyed it. But I didn't go into it as open-hearted as I sometimes am. And it wasn't with intent. It's just like, I have grown up I was born post-Vietnam. So like, war movies to me that I grew up on were the 70s Vietnam response movies, and then everything from the 80s and 90s that are revisiting those with a different critical lens. So I was making Houston prove this to me as we were watching this.
Well, I would probably share your reluctance to watch those sorts of films. And there's a whole bunch of them that I've stupidly kind of stayed away from. And interestingly, one of the ones that I had not seen, also with Robert Mitchum, is The Story of G.I. Joe, which Dwight Eisenhower called the best war film he'd ever seen. So, but you're right. It's not a genre or a period of history on film to which I feel drawn. So the The leads here helped allure me.
Yeah, and I will say there are World War II movies from this time that I find fascinating. Bridge on the River Kwai is a World War II movie that I find endlessly fascinating to think about. But, you know, that's a movie that's asking really interesting questions. And I guess my bias is it's like, well, this movie's not interested in interesting questions. And in fact, this movie is very interested in some interesting questions.
But not questions that you expect to be raised during a war.
Yes, that's exactly it. And there are some interesting symbolic movies or moments in this movie for thinking about the war, which we'll talk about. It was also interesting going in knowing that Deborah Kerr was playing a nun. And then I was thinking, this is another place where my guard is up. You know from movies we've watched on this that I'm a sucker for a movie that wants to dig into and ask interesting religious questions. And I was thinking, okay, what is this movie going to do with religion in the war? And is it going to tie them too closely together? I wanted this movie to ask interesting questions, but I didn't know if it was going to. And I was pleasantly surprised by what Houston found interesting about this situation and what he wasn't as interested in doing.
Well, you know, I like that you put it that way, Sam, because in some ways, another critic I read or reviewer I read pointed out that the attitude of the film towards Carr's vocation is very much like Mr. Allison's. Mm-hmm. It's a respectful kind of curiosity. And it's an effort to draw, I mean, all the parallels that he makes between his vocation as a Marine and her vocation in the church. It's an effort to kind of make sense of something that to those who do not have a religious calling or a vocation seems very odd to understand. And so it does what we tend to do as human beings. We try to put things we understand in one sense, translated in another sense. But at the same time, it can suggest a translation back the other way, because we do know that Mr. Allison's tenure in the Marines has supposedly created a kind of moral transformation in him, which is why, as one reviewer pointed out, they had no trouble getting the Pentagon's cooperation for this film, because it paints a very, very complimentary picture of the Marines. But it's interesting to me because it's not just I understand the church in terms of the Marines, but maybe you understand the Marines in terms of the church. He's kind of got that as a two-way equivalency.
Yeah, I mean, these are definitely two people who live by codes.
Yeah,
you know, who live by a set of understandings of the world and gain a lot from that. So we'll definitely dig more into that, because I think that's the central idea of this movie in lots and lots of ways. And then what does that lead them to when they're in this particular situation? One of the other things that I found interesting about this movie, just as I was watching it the first time, is that this movie is truly, truly, truly a two-hander.
Yes.
I mean, there is, it's not only this is about two people paired together, but I was going through this and I think there are three characters besides Allison and Sister Angela who speak a line of English in the entire film, and barely that. And they are not named characters. They are characters who exist for under 2 minutes in the movie and maybe under a minute in the movie. And then there's a few other characters who speak unsubtitled Japanese. So this is really, really, really two characters in this movie. So I was interested. It's like, not only does this movie not pass the Bechdel test by definition, it doesn't pass the masculine inversion of the Bechdel test, because Allison doesn't talk to anybody or any other man, right? It is just these two people, which is I think is a nice piece of storytelling, which is to say we don't need to show any of the stuff kind of before and after. We can talk about it, but we're going to really focus on these two people. And so that leads to kind of where the movie opens.
But at the same time, Sam, I want to insert that the other thing I appreciate about this is it also doesn't demonize the Japanese. Right. I mean, so the fact that their dialogue is untranslated puts you in the position of Allison. He doesn't understand Japanese, but there's no effort to make that. I mean, they're simply soldiers going about their business like any soldiers would. So I really appreciated that about it. I felt like I won't know if I go so far as to say they were humanized, but at least they weren't demonized. You saw them just as other participants in the war doing what we do in the war as well.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that was one of the questions I have. I mean, the main scene where we see the Japanese kind of, other than from a distance as a military group, where we're seeing individuals, is when Allison infiltrates the camp to try to steal food. Mm-hmm. And I really was stopping to think, like, okay, what is this movie trying to tell me about them? And I kind of landed at the same place you did, which is, not, they're not demons, they're not monsters, they're not, you know, warmongers, but it's also not humanizing. And I was trying to figure out, like, is there some other coded message that, just because we have this distance from this movie, that it's like, I couldn't figure out, like, were they supposed to come off as more like effeminate than Allison? I mean, you see them like dancing and drinking tea and bathing and like, or is that supposed to be like, oh, these are just regular guys? Like, I couldn't tell, because I can't watch this with 1957 eyes to know, like, is there something else coded into this that I can't read?
I think in 57 it would have seemed a pretty enlightened view of the Japanese. And I like that little scene that happens in the storeroom, because they're taking orders from or being told something by their superior, and then they're enjoying the sake and they're playing Go. It just seemed to me to suggest this is the way any barracks might look when people are kind of off duty. So to me, it was normalizing. Maybe that's the word I'll settle on.
Well, and it does remind me of scenes that you will see in later post-Vietnam War movies, where you're seeing the troops in camp and they're listening to music and they're singing and dancing together. Like if you switch the context, you can see a scene in Platoon that looks like that. You can see a scene in Full Metal Jacket that looks like that. So that's an interesting way to think about it. I'm going to land on an enlightened 1957 view like that, because I didn't know if there was something I was missing. And so like that always worries me a little bit. Like, am I just passing this off as saying, well, that's, you know, that's that is a you know, I was avoiding humanizing too, because it didn't quite feel like that, because they also are always shot from Allison's point of view. So they're, even when he's up close, they're at a distance from him. You know, the one he kills is in a full suit with a mask on. So he almost doesn't seem like a person, although the movie does reckon with, you killed this guy. I mean, that comes back later.
Well, let me just, as an aside, let me just point out, this is a movie I've not yet seen, but the next year Houston makes a film with John Wayne called The Barbarian and the Geisha, which is about John Wayne playing an ambassador to Japan who is completely baffled by Japanese culture. It's a clash of individuals and collectivism. So it's interesting. So in other words, I add that because Houston's obviously interested in the Eastern culture and what happens when Westerners encounter it.
Yeah, and you know, we should say this movie is 1957, so it is a full decade after the war. This is not right on the heels of, you know, right on the heels of the war. So I want to talk about the opening of this movie, because I think this is where we get the introduction to what I'm calling the third lead of the film. So it opens with Allison in this raft at sea. I was trying to think, we've watched a movie that opens this way. It's Christmas in Connecticut, also opens with two guys in a raft at sea.
That's right.
Very different movie that goes in a very different direction, but I love the way he shoots the credits, because it's silent, and then whenever like a credit appears, like the score comes up again and then it goes silent again and you just hear the waves, and so it's like reminding you of, like, putting you in this moment, reminding you of this movie, putting you in this moment, and even that has the kind of flow of waves.
Mm-hmm.
And we're literally seeing Allison just tossed at sea for a while, and then eventually he gets, you know, the waves bring him to this island. There's a great shot, the final shot of him in the raft when he gets out. It's like a POV of the raft, like it's a lockdown camp. It's really a great, I got excited, because that's very early in the movie. I'm like, okay, we're in the hands of somebody who wants to maybe do some interesting things here, because I really love that shot as he's dragging the raft up. So I'm gonna ask you, I have my thoughts on this, but I'm gonna ask you to start with, like, this movie keeps going back to this visual motif of waves. Why? What do the waves mean? Because you'll often see Allison staring out at them.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's not just that. It is a sustained shot of the waves kind of coming to you. Probably four or five times in the movie, Houston stops and just shows that.
Well, I mean, I think there's a number of things going on with the waves. And part of what I'm going to say is going to kind of take us a little bit towards the end of the film as well. But I mean, first of all, the waves are on the one hand, they're an escape route. They're the way you get off the island, right? But at the same time, they're obviously a barrier. They're preventing you from getting off the island. The waves can also function as a source of food. The waves can function as a source of recreation. So you can swim, you can bathe in them. So they can provide various sorts of functions. But they also, if you want to talk about the most symbolic level, they represent passion. And so the moment of Sister Angela's greatest temptation, when she's trying to figure out, should she accept his offer? And we can talk more about how she struggles with that. You get a kind of a classic cut to the waves. And along with the waves, the very thing you pointed out, Sam, the music. So the waves also, in a sense, are a visual representation of what you're hearing. And so the waves come crashing in, and they're kind of aligned with her passion that she's struggling with. There's also the moment where the waves become a source of cover when Allison is.
I love this scene.
And the Japanese, that's a great scene. And the Japanese come on. You know what I kept thinking? Yeah, this is silly, but I just kept thinking, that's not a stunt, man. That's actually Robert Mitchum clinging onto those rocks as those waves really hit him. This is like a Tom Cruise moment, right?
Yes.
So the waves at the same time are simultaneously danger, but they're also in the sense of kind of salvation, which is in a way how the island works. The island is a place where they're safe, but it's also a place that's dangerous. So the waves have that kind of, I don't know, built-in ambiguity.
Thinking about that scene where he gets cover in the waves, another thing I thought about in this movie, then I'm going to get back to waves, is this is a great movie about camouflage.
Yes.
Because you realize, because both Allison and Sister Angela have uniforms and they only wear one thing in this movie, and hers so explicitly stands out on the island where a plane flying over can see her dressed all in white. But it also symbolizes her. And his, so often, you'll see him in a scene and then he'll run somewhere and you kind of lose him, because you're like, especially mm-hmm. when he's got his face painted, and he'll just all of a sudden in the shadows or in the brush, it's like, well, I don't see him now. And then I see him again. And in that wave scene, you see that green uniform get wet and it just turns black, the color of the rocks. Not that this is the intent of this movie, but it sort of speaks to the effectiveness of camouflage, versus this kind of intentional standing out that what Sister Angela is wearing. So when I was thinking about the waves, I thought about some of the things you talked about. I also just thought about them as like, they also represent a sort of a bigger force in life that they can't control. And maybe passion and love is one of those things. But it's also, I mean, the fact that the opening scene is literally Allison in a boat with no control, getting tossed in the waves, and that the waves are the thing that brings him to the island. So you're right that they are the thing there. They're also the thing that you need to overcome. But I think about Allison's life, right? And when Allison talks about his life is sort of being tossed about for quite a while, right? He talks about being an orphan child who's just sort of left, so the waves, the metaphorical waves of life, toss him to this orphanage. And in some ways, when he escapes the orphanage, he's then tossed about. He talks about spending more times in jails than he does in churches. And then the waves of life lead him to the Marine Corps, and that becomes an island for him, a mooring for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because what is his name?
His first name?
Yes.
I don't think we know.
He doesn't have one, right? He's only ever listed as U.S. Marine Corps Corporal Allison. So if you think about that name, U.S. Marine Corps is just his branch of service. Corporal is his title. And where does Allison come from? Do you know?
No.
You remember? It's the name of the orphanage, because he goes to the Allison Street Orphanage.
Oh.
So literally, he kind of doesn't, his identity is assigned to him by the waves. You know, like it's not, they're not names that he was given by somebody. It's like they're just things that kind of happened to him. I thought a lot about this as like, because it's a throwaway line where he says, I'm the Allison Street orphan.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's really interesting. You know, like he is literally somebody who has no inherited identity, you know, from family, or I mean, he talks a lot about not having a family, but like even his name is symbolic of that.
Yeah, oh, that's really interesting, Sam. Yeah, he doesn't have a family name, so he is the creation of various institutions.
Okay, let me go with this. So interestingly, we don't get a backstory on Sister Angela. She never says why she became a nun. She talks about why others become nuns, right? She talks about Sister Mary Fidelis, and you know, who was a model, but she found her most happiness in the Lord. And I think about the name Sister Angela. Sister is again a title.
Yeah.
Now this is this is you know, decades before Vatican II. There's a good chance Angela's not her name, not her like birth name, right? Because until Vatican II, after Vatican II, a lot of folks in religious orders got to take their original names back. So we're dealing with two characters who are part of these systems and institutions, and in some ways it shapes their identity to that extent where there is a giving up of yourself to these, you know, I don't know what, if there are waves that brought Angela to the convent or not, but definitely Allison is tossed by the waves and given his identity by those waves. But it's interesting to think about both of those names are like, these are not traditional ways we think about how people get their names.
Well, it also heightens, as long as we're talking about symbolism or maybe more precisely allegory, it also heightens the idea that they are not just individuals, but they are representatives of each of those, you know, military and church. And you could argue, if you wish, that there's a larger argument going on here about the various virtues and even the similarities between the church and the military. It makes me think of a film we watched a couple of weeks ago. I just watched it for the third time. Matter of Life and Death, and the way we talked about those characters in that film being representative of Britain and the United States respectively. And I want to say, in the case of both filmmakers, I don't think you sit there thinking, I'm watching Pilgrim's Progress, this is such an obvious allegory. So maybe symbolism is a better word, but it certainly does have those greater resonances for other beyond just those characters.
Absolutely. No, and I mean, the movie goes out of its way to say, like, well, how are these two people going to relate to each other? And the first way they start to relate to each other is they talk about their respective kind of parent institutions. You know, they each have their kind of transformative initiation, and they talk about their respective drill instructors. I love when, you know, he's talking about his DI, and it's sort of like he's trying to explain what makes him unique as a Marine, and then she says, well, I had my own DI, and talks about Sister Brigida, and I was like, okay, I'm in now. If we're going to talk about nuns and Marines in parallel, this is great. Their identities and symbols are shaped by this. So he has this great line, you know, you've got your cross and I have my globe and anchor, to say like these kind of are who we are. And then, as you already indicated, the way that Allison talks about being a Marine, he was talking about his drill instructor, you know, being hard on him. And he says, and then I saw the light. I started to become a Marine. Other guys have homes and families. Me, I have the Corps, like you have your church. It's almost a monastic view of being a Marine that he has, right? Like he's really struggling with, like, as a Marine, is it even responsible for me to have a family, right? Mm-hmm. Now, he's in some ways, he's kind of justifying his rejection towards the end, where he's like, ah, marriage isn't good for a Marine anyhow, and all this stuff. But I think there's part of him that believes that, and there's part of him that wants an identity beyond being a Marine. But it's very religious language that he uses to talk about the Corps.
Well, you know, what I find interesting is, Sam, is that yes, on the one hand, they kind of figure out how their different vocabularies are describing very similar experiences, but then there's points where he goes into such Marine jargon and American jargon, she has no idea what he's talking about. So you know where I'm going with this. He talks about the scuttlebutt, the poop, beating their gums. And finally, he gets to rumors. And then I love the way Sister Angela responds. She says, yes, of course, rumors. Well, they don't seem to beat their gums on very hopeful poop, do they, Miss Ross?
Yes.
And even when he's going to bed, he's going to climb into the rack. And she has no idea what this means. Bed down, you know, go to sleep. So I think they're getting, you know, it's classic English humor about the people who speak English, but they're separated by a common language. And of course, that's the first quarter of the film is kind of relies on that humor as they try to kind of get to know each other a little bit. You get that really ridiculously silly scene of him being towed by the turtle.
Yes.
We could talk a little bit about the way the tone changes in the film, right? But at the beginning, it's quite humorous.
I'm glad you talk about that because there is this point in the movie once they've sort of connected and started to talk where again, knowing nothing about this movie, I'm sort of asking myself, okay, what direction do they want to go? And it's like, well, they want to go in sort of a Robinson Crusoe, Swiss Family Robinson sort of way. And the turtle scene sort of feels like that. It's like, oh, maybe this is going to be sort of this comedic movie about these people creating this life on this island. You know, or is this going to be an island escape movie? Because then they start to talk about how they're going to build this boat and you see them start to build that. And then, you know, quickly it's like, well, no, this is actually going to be a war film because the Japanese bomb the island out and then they invade. So then I'm thinking, is this going to be like a rebellion film or like a POW film? Like where does this want to go? And then the whole time there's this creeping sense in my head of like, man, this feels like a love story. But the movie has set itself up where I'm like, well, but it can't be that. He keeps pointing me in that direction, but I'm like, but like this, the math doesn't check out. And I'm like, there's no way in 1957 that this is a love story between a Marine and a nun. Like it can't be. and then you realize, well, the film actually wants to mesh all of these things together. Mm-hmm. And the thing it's kind of most interested in is the questions about the love story part, which I thought was like, oh, that's just a feint in a direction, but he can't lean in and into that direction. And I feel like it's handled really deftly.
Yeah. And it's deftly. And, you know, one of my misgivings about the film is that is Allison kind of too good to be true? Evidently the book on the novel on which the film is based does take it in a much more of an R-rated direction than this film goes. And so I kept worrying or wondering to myself about how, I don't know, realistic, I suppose you could say, you know, how realistic is it that somebody like Allison placed in a situation like this would really kind of resist the clear temptation that Sister Angela presents, especially later on when we have to deal with her wet clothes. And I think the answer has to be, right, that you believe enough in the discipline that Allison says has shaped him as who he is, which is why they spend so much time on that. And the same thing is true for her, that it becomes believable that these two people, I mean, he calls her ma'am the whole time. And she calls him Mr. Allison the whole time. You know, you have to believe these two people are so powerfully conditioned by that ethos that they actually can deal with each other in a very kind of subtle way. So you don't need the Hays Code to make sure that things don't go down a different track.
Because you have the Catholic Church and the Marine Corps to do it for you. And I think you're right. I mean, like I think the most amazing thing in this movie, and I'm just going to be teeing you up here, is how great Robert Mitchum is in this movie. Like, I know Deborah Carr got an Oscar nomination for this, but I'm like, the key to this movie is Mitchum's performance, because at one level, like, you see him... if you're watching the things he does, you see him as this figure, this kind of masculine Marine Corps can do. He can survive there. You have this sense of that. And there's even these questions of like where she wants to turn herself in because she's like, well, I have no doubt you can survive here. But if you have to take care of me, too, does that put you in danger? And you're thinking about the ages of these people. So Mitchum's 40 in this movie. Kerr is 36, which is interesting because I think they're. At one level, they definitely feel grown up, but they also feel much younger than those ages. But what's interesting to me is that Mitchum plays Allison. And again, I think this is seated in the stuff we get of his backstory with so much of almost like the naivete of a child. At the same time, he's a can-do Marine. When he approaches Sister Angela, I think a big piece of this comes from, like, he's kind of confused about how do you interact with a nun? It's almost like she is an alien or otherworldly figure, because he's confused. Like, he's like, are you different than other nuns? Because he has this picture in his head of, like, well, mm-hmm. nuns are this thing. And he's like, but you're like, you tell jokes and you talk like a normal person sometimes, and you're young and you're pretty. So he has this confusion. And I think the energy that I feel from him is like maybe like a middle schooler or a young high schooler who has a crush on his teacher, which is both, you know, awkward, it's impossible, but it's also not unreal. Like that happens, right? And so you watch him so much, like, trying to please her, and the way he's trying to please her is in the awkward way that, like, a childhood crush on an adult would be, right? Like, he brings her the cross from the church. It's like he doesn't even fully understand the church, but he's like, I think you would want this. When he makes her, the big one is when he makes her the comb.
Yeah.
And it's just like this sense of, like, I'm trying to, like, it's not exactly courting, but it's like, I don't quite know how to do this, but I feel like I should give you something. And I feel like there's something between, like, there is something about the way he portrays Allison that I think is really powerful. He's very sweet. And it's such a contradiction to, you know, 2 years earlier, he plays Reverend Powell in Night of the Hunter. And, like, this is a whole different being here. And I just thought that performance is amazing.
Yeah, I fully agree, Sam. And, you know, and I think he should have gotten some kind of recognition for it as well, because as you already indicated, you know, especially the longer an actor's career comes along, you have certain expectations. So when a Robert Mitchum shows up in 1957, as you said, you've got Harry Powell in your head. Or from a different angle, I've got Jeff Bailey from Out of the Past, who's, you know, he's a kind of a cynical character. So Mitchum has that kind of air about him. At the same time, and this is entirely me making a completely anachronistic remark, but Robert Mitchum it reminds me very much in a lot of ways of John Cusack. And sometimes it's a speech pattern, often more it's a look on his face, and you get that very early in this film. And Cusack, and I realize this has nothing to do with 1957, but it can't help but influence the way I look at him. And I reframe him as Cusack, and Cusack is a very different, plays very different characters usually than Mitchum plays. You know, he plays characters that are vulnerable, that do have a sense of naivete about them, that do have a sense of hesitancy, all those things you kind of see that Mitchum captures here. And the other thing that happens, of course, when he encounters Sister Angela is she's exotic. She doesn't immediately present as, you know, whatever fantasies he may be having about women as a Marine, it certainly isn't a nun. And so she presents as exotic and pretty desexualized. And of course, you know, that outfit she wears kind of screams, you know, I'm holy, I'm set apart, I'm different. And so I think all of those things kind of tap into his sense of, as you said earlier, this is something that is different, and I'm really interested in it. And I can't put it necessarily in any category that I had for women before, but I can put her in the category as a fellow Marine. Mm-hmm. Right. I can understand. Okay. This is what leads to, I respect her because I live by my Marine code. She's got this other code that she lives by. So the best way for us to coexist is to respect and live by each other's codes. So that's why I think the film spends so much time on that early on, right? There's not just this symbolic allegorical aspect, but it's a way of establishing this is why they're, to put it crudely, why they're able to keep their hands off of each other. Mm-hmm. Because they both really are committed to their respective vocations.
And it's in all of that is why it is so heartbreaking when he, yeah. I mean, it's a great scene when he proposes because he starts to, and then he doesn't. And yeah. then he starts to, and you're like, okay, well, it's too early in the movie for him to say this yet. And then he actually just asks her, and I was kind of blown away that I figured, well, this is leading to this. This is going to happen, but it's weird that it's happening now. And I'm like, what is her response can't be yes.
Yeah.
Right. Like, but what is it going to be and how is this going to work? And like, again, it is this heartbreaking thing of this is weird to think about Mitchum as this, like, you know, Marie 40-year-old. I mean, obviously he's playing a character who I assume is younger, but like masculine man of the world, Marine Corps. There is something virginal about him too, yes. Though, where it's like, his Marine exterior betrays, again, this is somebody who never had attention, never had love as a child. So he's approaching her almost in that way too, of like, I am seeking love in a kind of way. And it makes her rejection of him, which you of course know is going to happen, hit so much harder.
Did you want her to say yes, even if you knew she wouldn't?
No, because I didn't want it to be that film.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
like I was both, and this is why it's a really good movie, is I was both, I'm pulling for him and for them, but it's like, but I don't want this the movie where they fall in love. Because Houston even opens the door up to say, like, well, she hasn't taken her final vows yet. Right. So there is an out that's already been introduced. So I was like, shoot, I hope they don't do that. And then I was thinking, like, 1957, I was thinking about like the National Catholic League of Decency and their problems with Black Narcissus, and I'm like, there's no way she leaves the order for this guy, because like this movie wouldn't exist. So I had all the I was torn in all these ways, and so I was wondering, like, how are they gonna handle it more than anything else?
But she, you know, she comes so close. Mm-hmm. Right, because when she comes up to him on the beach and she starts to say, well, you know, I haven't, it's true, I haven't taken my final vows, right? And then he comes back with, well, I was a, you know, I'm sorry I ever said that to you. I never should have. And so it's a wonderful moment, right? Because, I mean, we've all had moments like this where, you know, you're talking to a friend or a family member, you know, they have certain values, certain things are important to them. And they're about to do something that seems contradictory to what they believe. And you end up talking them out of it by reflecting back to them what they've said about themselves, right? So, and that's exactly what he does here. And it's got this double, there's this double message, because it's, well, maybe he's doing that because he's really heard her argument. He's reflecting it back to her. But also, as you were saying earlier, he's realizing that, nah, it's not a good thing for a Marine. Marines shouldn't be married. You know, that's not fair, which actually is actually a pretty good argument. I mean, he's probably right. He's probably right about that.
Except for what he's really saying there is, I shouldn't be married. Because he does say, you know, other Marines have families, or, you know, we haven't gotten to the apple tree
right.
motif in this movie. But like, there is the sense that most of the other Marines do have somebody waiting for them. Yeah. So when he's saying a Marine shouldn't do that, he's saying, I shouldn't do that. And what he's really, I mean, getting into therapy here, what he's really saying is, I don't deserve it.
Yeah.
And like, that's the part that's heartbreaking, because like,
yes,
this
yeah.
is the kid who was abandoned, who grew yeah. up in an orphanage, who, like, it's like, that's the psych 101 of this. And it's like, that's the part that's so hard to hear.
But I'm so glad, you know, because it's 1957, and often you don't get those romantic expectations being thwarted. So I'm so grateful that the movie stayed true to its own principles in that.
Well, and apparently, this was on the Wikipedia page, it talked about how Kerr and Mitchum, there's an ad lib scene where they kiss, and it's like, when I read that, I'm like, thank God that's not in this
yes,
movie.
Absolutely.
Like, and I was trying to figure out, like, where in the movie would that scene, let's pretend it had to be in the movie, where would it make sense? Like, what is the point where I can't picture it. And it kind of ruins, I mean, it ruins the movie almost by definition, but like, I can't even picture an organic moment that feels right for that.
No, not at all. I mean, unless you get one of those movie moments where, you know, the bombs are falling and suddenly they have to take comfort in each other's arms. I don't know, but
yeah,
you're right.
Yeah.
I can't see how it could work. I mean, you have to believe that they knew that Houston would cut that.
Right.
So maybe they're just taking the opportunity before it slipped away.
That's right. So one of my favorite scenes in this movie is when Allison and Angela are at the mouth of the cave and they're watching the naval battle and they're at a distance. Because this is also, I feel like, symbolic of this movie's relationship to the war, right? The war is happening. The war is very real. The war is impacting them, but it's also at this distance, right? He says it's like having $2 seats to a Joe Louis fight, ain't it? Just too far away to see anything. So it's like they can see the effects of it, but they can't, but they don't actually get to see it. And what I love about this movie is that that's the movie's stance towards the war too, is like, this is happening, this is impacting everything, but we're not gonna have a battle scene, you know, because the great heroic military moment of this movie is him disabling guns, right? Him taking the backs off the howitzers. And that seemed like such a well-observed moment that I'm wondering, like, I would love to know where that idea came from, because I'm sure there are tons of stories of folks who fought in the war talking about what it felt like to watch hot battle going on at a distance and knowing there are people out there fighting and dying, and like, and you have this weird both proximity and distance from it. Like, that seemed like a specifically well-observed moment to me.
And it's also, adds greatly to the uncertainty because, you're at a distance, but you don't know who won. And so it sets up a great moment of suspense. Interestingly enough, for what it's worth, the novel was evidently set in 1942, the film set in 1944. So maybe so I guess that means the prospect of rescue in 44 is greater than it was in 42. I don't know how the book handled that, but I think that's, when the battle he mentions that he was involved in, tells you that the Americans are maybe starting to turn the tide a little bit.
So after that, and the Japanese leave the island, then we get this like this sense of they're waiting for the Americans. Then they kind of realize that, okay, maybe they're not coming. And then it's like we circle back to, well, what if we have a life here again? What so it's sort of back to Robinson Crusoe, kind of like, okay, well, now we need to shape a life here. And here's where he makes the after he proposes, then he when he gets drunk, he makes this speech about like, what is the point if we are the only two people on this island potentially for years? What's the point of me being a Marine and you being a nun? It's like, do our codes matter if we're the I mean, he talks about being the first two people on Earth. I think in the Cold War, when this movie comes up, you're probably also thinking, what would it mean if you were the last two people on Earth? Would those codes matter anymore? Because
Well,
they're kind of in a bomb shelter, sort of, if nobody comes.
I mean, it's interesting because she doesn't give the answer here. She gave the answer back at the beginning of the film when he says you're alone here. And she says, God has been with me. So if you want to raise the Adam and Eve image, unfortunately for him, that plays into her sense of reality, which is, well, Adam and Eve, they were the only two people, but God was there as well.
So it's also in this moment after the Japanese leave when he starts singing the Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree, and it becomes this auditory. I mean, he keeps singing it and she asks him about it, and this leads to, questions about does he not have somebody back home waiting for him? And she's like, oh, a handsome young man like you should be married. And this leads to his proposal. And then she shows him her ring, right? And we realize, like, oh, she is in essence, she's somebody who's waiting for her suitor and she is engaged. Like, I love that. I don't know if nuns do that, like the engagement. I don't know if that's I've never heard of that. I mean, very well could be, but it was interesting to be like, oh, I'm actually going to use the same symbology of engagement and marriage with these rings. And it sort of turns the apple tree song on its head a little bit and realizing, like, if God is the one saying to her, save yourself for me, or she's saving herself for God, then Allison is somebody who's trying to sit under the apple tree with her in a different kind of way. And it's like and then what's great is the final images of this movie when Allison is getting stretchered out, right? And she's walking alongside him. I mean, I under playing underneath that is a version of Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree. And I couldn't help but think about, like, almost the marriage imagery of this, like as if they're walking down the aisle, she's carrying the cross like it's a bouquet of like it's a bridal bouquet, and I'm like, that's a perfect ending for this movie. And like, because it's like, I mean, they have their farewells, and their farewells are so great because there's the formality of the ma'am and Mr. Allison, where he's like, you know, it was a pleasure getting to know you. And she talks about, I forget her. She says, no matter how many miles apart we are, or if I ever see your face again, you will always be my dear companion. So there is this kind of finality to it, but there it's like, that's the version of a proclamation of love that they can have.
Yeah, it's surprisingly satisfying. And I love the little touch as he comes along on the stretcher. She's helping him with the cigarette, which is, you know, wonderful, wonderful little touch. Yes. But you know, kind of back to the moment of the proposal, you know, and he gets drunk, which is another moment of Marine jargon, right? He says, I'm pitching myself a liberty. Mm-hmm. And then I just love the point where he says to her, if you have to be a nun, why can't you be old and ugly? Why do you have to have big blue eyes and a beautiful smile and freckles? And you get this moment where, I mean, it's also wonderfully ambiguous because he thinks that she's run away because she feels threatened by him. You know, and she says, you know, I know you would never hurt me. She runs away because of her own temptation of what he's actually proposing. So it's a great scene in that it captures both of those perspectives at the same time.
Well, it's temptation or it's the realization. I mean, because what she actually says is, I was running from the truth. Now, the truth could be temptation, or it could be, you're right. If it is just you and I here, do these codes matter? Yeah. And like, would it be, and if we want to keep it in her religious realm, like, is it actually at that point more pleasing to God that she set herself apart? Like it's making her question those big things, which leads to another thing that I really liked about this movie, which is, I was afraid maybe this would be a film about Allison's conversion somehow. Oh, I was like, okay. You know, and the closest thing we get to like, Sister Angela's really got no interest in like trying to preach to him very much. Like they have conversations about faith and these types of things. The closest thing they get is that she says a prayer for him, and it's not that he'll change, but that God will accept him in heaven. So she's like, I know he is who he is, but like, give him a pass. Like this is a good man. And then we have this moment, you know, where Allison claims to hear God's voice.
Okay.
And she has this question, like, are you sure that it's God you're obeying and not just your natural desires to take part in the fighting? And he gives kind of a, like, I think so answer.
He says pretty sure.
And what I love is, I was so happy that this movie has no interest in answering that question.
That's right.
Was it divine inspiration or just a Marine with a good idea? But the idea is, how can we minimize the loss of life?
Right.
You know, that again, his greatest military victory in this is disabling the guns so that people don't have to die.
Yeah.
You know, or as many people don't have to die. And that's the thing, when he comes back and he says, mission accomplished, and I did it and nobody died.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't have, because she seems so upset that he kills the guy when he goes to get the linens.
Yes.
So and that's what his comment to her there is really interesting. He said, I'm a Marine. I've been trained. That was the enemy. I've been trained to kill the enemy. I've gotten too far away from what I'm called to do because of you. Like, it's kind of blaming yourself. Like, you've made me less of a Marine, and my Marine parts kicked back in there. And at the end, it's this fusion of, I am a Marine. I'm doing my military duty, but I can also do it in a way that doesn't mean a bunch of people have to die. Like, that's the closest thing to a salvation kind of thing for him. And I really like that.
Yeah, that is great.
Is there anything else you want to talk about with this movie?
I just wanted to kind of follow through and connecting it with a couple of other movies where you have this kind of trope of two very different people tossed together and needing to kind of deal with each other. And there's probably dozens of movies like that. But we've already talked about The African Queen. And I mentioned Hell in the Pacific, which is kind of the masculine version of this. We might want to think about a film we watched, I don't know, about a year and a half ago or so, the Tony Curtis, Sidney Poitier, The Defiant Ones.
Oh, sure.
About the two escaped prisoners, you know, that are literally handcuffed to each other. Another film kind of like this is Harrison Ford and Anne Heche's 7 Days and Six Nights is another example. There's the one with Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro.
Oh, Midnight Run.
Yeah. I mean, so it's just interesting. So if you know that, so you talked earlier about one genre to put this film in, we could put it in that genre as well. To me, I think that's where it really fits.
Certainly. No. And as we said, Kerr's nominated for an Oscar. Houston's nominated for an Oscar for writing on this. One of the things that blew me away is I look at the like murderer's row of like iconic movies that John Huston made. And he's nominated, I think, for 14 Oscars. And the only thing he ever wins for is Treasure of Sierra Madre.
Yeah.
I think he has like 5 directing nominations and 8 writing and 1 for a supporting actor. But it's just sort of, I mean, the Oscars are weird. They're what they are, but it's just sort of strange. Like, how could he have made all of this? And like only the one time does he reach the mountaintop with that. So it's an interesting career.
And the 50s was a good decade for both Mitchum and Carr. She was in From Here to Eternity, The End of the Affair, The King and I, Tea and Sympathy, Separate Tables, Bonjour Tristesse. So they were both really kind of at the top of their game when they made this film.
Yeah. So I will say, I mean, to put a cap on this, like I went into this movie with trepidation and like I really thought this was an interesting movie. I really enjoyed it. It was far better than what I was preparing myself for. Because I also will say, like, if it both is all those things that I was trepidation with, and it's like, and I've never heard of this. So so this to me points to the fact that there are so many really, really good to great, interesting movies that it's like this movie feels lost to time in a way where it's like, I mean, I'm pretty aware of a lot of films, and like this is like I just have never heard of this, and definitely worth the watch. And again, I think it raises interesting questions that are going to stick with me when I think about some of this stuff.
Yeah, it's very G-rated, and so you could watch this with the whole family and have some interesting conversations and be entertained. Yeah, it's a gem, and I wish, I don't know how I came upon it, but I'm glad I did.
Yeah, well, what do you have for us for? We're taking a week off next week, so we'll be back in 2 weeks. What do you have for us?
Well, I guess I could argue, Sam, this film, if we're doing a series of films that loosely explore religious vocation one way or the other, I guess that's where I'll fit this film in. This is a South Korean film from 2003 called Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter, and Spring. Which I hate. I'm afraid I hate the title of this film. I always have a hard time remembering. But once I remember to begin with Spring, then I can get it. And it's on Prime Video. And it's the South Korean director Kim Ki-duk.
I'm fantastic. Never heard of this movie. Don't know anything about it. But that's usually a good recipe. Plus, if you tell me this is about people exploring religious vocation in some way, like that's catnip to me. That's the stuff I'm excited about. So thank you so much for recommending this film, for having this conversation. This was really great. And I will say this, I'm increasing my affection for Robert Mitchum as an actor. Like I, this is just a different picture of him. And again, I think this performance by him is spectacular, especially because of the baggage even I bring in of thinking about who he is, and he plays a very different character and plays him in interesting, complex, layered ways. So if nothing else, watch this for the Robert Mitchum performance. So thank you for recommending this. Thank you for having this conversation. That is all the time that we have, but we will be back in 2 weeks to talk about Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter, and Spring in the Video Store.